would you take away?
Great. Well, thanks very much. I probably won't need all the time. So yesterday I sat down and decided, you know, not to mix and match from other results, but rather than that, just give you one thing and not go into too much detail. And hopefully that will leave us more time for discussion. And obviously I'm here for two more weeks, so I think it's nice if we could send in front of the backboard at any time if you're interested in more details. So what I would like to talk about today is quantum system identification, and that's a collaboration work I did with Kazuo Yuasa in Waseda University. And I would like to apologize for those of you who were in Banff, because there's a certain amount of overlap with the talk I gave there, although I want to emphasize some of the newer stuff towards the end. So the outline of the talk, there are many ways of motivating system identification, but I want to give you my personal motivation, what brought me to this subject. And then I'm going to ask the natural question, how is control or quantum control going to help us for this purpose of system identification? And then the core part of the talk will be this relationship between equivalence and similarity, and the consequences of this. And I give an example. And then I give the conclusion and a little bit of an outlook that will hopefully be able to, you know, contribute to the discussions here. And there are some parts where I'm a little bit stuck mathematically, so I'd really appreciate some input from your side to help me out there. So what is my motivation of this? Actually, when you read experimental papers, they always start with the Hamiltonian of the system is given by. And this was something that already, you know, struck me as when I was a grad student. You know, where do these Hamiltonians come from? So where do they come from? Well, of course they do come from underlying physics quite often. So if you know what your particles are, and there are some famous physicists that derive the interaction type of these particles, then that's a good starting point for Hamiltonian. Often there's quite a bit of intuition. And quite often there's also just fitting data. So you often find results where someone says, we measure the spectrum and this is exactly the spectrum of this and that Hamiltonian, so therefore it is this Hamiltonian. In principle, there's also this big machinery of process tomography, which really allows you to nail down the Hamiltonian. But do people really use it? Well, not so much, because it's requiring a lot of resources, a lot of processing and so on, and a lot of control. So usually you'll find these first three reasonings, or actually usually the reasoning is to cite someone else who says that this is the Hamiltonian of that system, you know, and then it ends up in this chain. So this was what made me interested in the idea of process tomography or system identification. Also, you know, once you claim that something is your Hamiltonian, I was interested in the question is how sure can we be that the model is actually correct? And in particular, I was interested in the problem of having systematic errors there. Because the thing is that quantum mechanics is kind of small and invisible, so, you know, it's easy to have some prejudices. For example, you know, if you do measurements of your system, you need to be sure what your measurements actually are. And so if you don't really know what your measurements are, then you'll have systematic errors on what you think your system is. And vice versa, you need to know what your state is. And it could well be that there's some systematic error that you'll never be able to find out because you got all of them wrong simultaneously. Okay. So this was what brought me into this subject. And the goal then was to find a way of characterizing how well a given system can be estimated. And because I'm quite lazy, I wanted to have a way that is independent of the specific protocol that people use. So I wanted you know, when you speak to experimentalists, they have very sophisticated and great methods of finding their system, but often I don't really understand how they work. So I wanted to have a way of checking what they can find out about their system without actually having to think too much about the specific protocol. And I think for control theorists, this is quite a natural approach, because it is analogous to the idea of reachability. So reachability tells you, given a controllable system, given a system and controls, which states or which evolutions can be reached in principle, but again, it doesn't really bother about how to reach those evolutions. Now, another aspect that I was interested in is how does quantum control help for system identification? And it's obvious that it does help, right? So I used to do these experiments when I was a little boy, and maybe you can relate to that. So the idea of using controls, you shake the system, and then that helps you to learn something about it. And the example I had was this one here. I don't know if you remember that, you know, you shake it and then you try to find out whether there's a great toy inside or a boring toy. Of course, usually it's the boring one. Now, one thing is that it's trivial that if we know how to control the system, so if we fully control the system and we know how to control it, I want to distinguish between these two things. I'll come back to that later, but if you really know how to, say, do quantum computation on your system, then it's trivial that you can find out everything about it, because you could, for example, use process tomography. So the more interesting question is what if you have limited access to the system? So you don't already have full controllability. And this is the case for this Kinder surprise where you're obviously not allowed to open it before you buy it. So now I can explain a little bit better what the model is that we looked at. And it's an analogy to some work by Eduardo Sontag, who's a well-known control theorist who works in bilinear systems. And there's quite a lot of, we could follow this work quite closely, actually, because quantum mechanics, after all, is a bilinear control system. But we have to do some non-trivial translations, which I won't go into. So this is the model. So you have your controller, you have your system, and you have your measurements. So the controller are some pulses that we apply to the system, so fk of t. And the measurements, in our case, are going to be some von Neumann measurements of the evolved state under the presence of this pulse. And in the middle, there's the system. And in our case, the system is described by some initial state, by some system Hamiltonian. But also, I want to put inside of the system, in some sense, the quantum mechanical description of what your pulse does to the system. So I want to think of your pulse as an entirely classical object, and all the quantum description I want to attach into the system at the moment. So you apply this pulse, which corresponds to some field in the system, might be a magnetic field, might be a laser field, but in general you might not even know what it is. And likewise, for the measurement, I want to also put that into the system at the moment.
Sorry, Dan, you said you won't know what it is, you're not, these fields, these pulses might be unknown?
You know the pulse, mm-hmm. but you don't know which operator it attaches to in your experiment. Okay. So in some sense, you go to your lab, you've had an accident, you lost all memory about your experiment, and all you see is your computer program where you can input the pulse and you get output the data. So that's kind of the first approach that I'd like to take. So likewise, you don't really know what you measure. You get some output. And so all of this I put into the system. And now with this setup, I can describe to you what I mean with equivalence and similarity, and hopefully describe what the relationship between the two are. Are there any other questions at this point? Or?
Your measurement results are in terms of expectation values.
Yes. So this is actually a good comment, because what I'm going to assume here is that I'm not going to bother about efficiency and numbers of copies of the system. There's obviously a lot of interesting research that goes into that. But here I'm assuming that we have basically infinitely many versions of the system. Yeah, infinitely many copies. And so I don't need to bother about the back action of the measurement on the system, and I can use enough statistics to get these expectation values, and they will tell me everything I need to know. Another set of assumptions that I'm going to make is, first of all, I'm going to assume that the system is finite dimensional and that we know the system dimension. It's obviously quite a strong assumption already. And also, I'm going to assume that everything that happens within the system is going to be unitary. This is an assumption that really bothers me, and I'd like to get rid of it, but at the moment, please accept that. Okay, so the first idea is to talk about equivalent systems. So I call two systems. So this is one system, this is another system, so I put a hat on it. I call them equivalent if whatever you do with the system, so for all pulses, if you have identical pulses, you get identical results. So this is, I think, quite obvious. And by definition, we can only estimate a system up to this equivalence, right? Because if two systems behave in the same way, whatever we do, then we cannot distinguish between them. So finding out in which of these equivalence classes you are is, in some sense, the goal of system identification. And if you have enough access to your system, this is going to be a unique system. But if you don't, then there's going to be a lot of classes, a lot of elements within that class. Now, unfortunately, these classes are not so easy to characterize mathematically. So that's why we're now going to talk about similar systems, which are much easier to characterize mathematically. But the real goal is to really find out which equivalence class am I in, or how big is this equivalence class. So similar systems, I denote with a triddle here. Similar systems is if there is a unitary operation W, such that the first system is similar to the second system in the sense of unitary conjugation. So in more detail, what I mean is that one system is just a unitary rotation of the other for the system Hamiltonian, for the initial state, for the pulses that you apply to the system, and for the measurements that you perform on your system. So in some sense, one system is just a rotated version of the other. So obviously, this is an easy mathematical description, because it's just unitary conjugation. We know how to play with that. And so what is the relationship between these two things, equivalence and similarity, right? So obviously, if two systems are similar, then they're equivalent. I hope you all agree with that, because one way of thinking of it is that there's some kind of hidden translator sitting between you and the system. So, you know, it's like communicating with someone in China and having a perfect translator in between. You won't be able to find out that the guy is Chinese, right? Because everything you say is translated into Chinese and then back into English again. So here, the measurement is rotated, but also the state is rotated, the evolution is rotated, so you won't be able to see that.
There's also the density matrix that also has to be rotated.
Everything is rotated, yes.
So if you use the same density matrix, then they're not necessarily equivalent by your first definition, even if they're unitarily equivalent.
No, you have to rotate everything. So the initial density matrix is rotated. And then if you just think about time evolution, all these unitary conjugations cancel out.
Okay, I'm just thinking that you might take a system that's unitarily equivalent to another, but if you're not careful about making sure to rotate your density matrix, you might not think they were equivalent.
Of course, yeah.
I mean, that's the probe, that's the experiment, right?
No, maybe I don't understand. Is it a question or comment or?
Well, maybe both. Okay, but I mean, you have to somehow have some knowledge of what W is in order to do this. Otherwise, if you make the same kind of measurement for early equivalent Hamiltonian, you won't get the same answer. So if you don't know what W is ahead of time, you won't see it.
Right. What I'm after is not knowing what W is or applying W or something like that, but it's more like which systems give you the same input-output behavior.
Okay,
so equivalent systems is the definition of systems that give you the same input-output behavior, and similar systems, so if you are sure that this relationship holds between two systems, will also give you the same input-output behavior.
Right, and you're saying you can be sure of that? Can you be sure of that?
No, I'm thinking the other way around.
Well, exactly, it's true, but I'm just saying.
It's just a mathematical question at the moment.
Okay.
Maybe it will become clear in a moment.
So is W a constant matrix, or it could be time varying?
It's a constant matrix.
That's the initial density matrix, right? So then.
W is the unitary.
Yeah. Then you rho naught is the initial.
Rho naught is the initial.
So it will be preserved for all time.
Well, it will evolve under the Hamiltonian and under your pulse. But because you're applying the same pulse on both systems, this evolution will still cancel out. Okay, so when systems are unitarily conjugated, they behave in the same way. But the converse is of course wrong. So the converse, if two systems behave in the same way, there must be a unitary translation between them is wrong. And I mean, you can make many counterexamples, but maybe this one is a simple one. So this is a system living on a tensor product structure, so two systems really. And the Hamiltonian of one system is, say, A times 1. And the Hamiltonian of the other one is A times 1 plus 1 times B, right? And all the other stuff is the same, and in such a way that you never touch the second system. So whatever you do with your system, with your pulse, here, if you apply this time-dependent operator here, I mean through some pulse, it won't change anything on the second system, it won't couple the first and the second system, so nothing will ever depend on the second system. So obviously you cannot expect to learn anything about B, and there's no reason why these two Hamiltonians should be unitarily conjugated, because you can still choose B to be anything.
I'm just wondering why you choose the words like this. I mean, usually common language equivalent is a stronger statement than similar. So you would think if something is equivalent, then necessarily it should be similar, but not the other way around.
But it's an equivalence class, so it's not really, they're not really the same.
Okay, similar is in the sense of a similarity transformation.
It might be better to say, instead of similar, unitarily equivalent. And in the case of equivalent, something like observable, because it's observability.
Okay.
Well, engineering term would be identifiability. Yeah.
Well, I mean, in the notation of this, we follow Sontag's work, so all the blame something. But
yeah, when you talk about equivalence between dynamical systems, so this is indeed equivalence.
Same behavior.
Yeah. So equivalence is the same behavior for all same inputs, and similarity is this mathematical thing in my language. But I mean, as long as you understand what I'm after, I'm not too worried about terminology.
Just a technical point about this example, right? You did assume that the finite dimension was known.
Yes.
So this kind of tacking on an unobservable subsystem that sort of not only are they, it's kind of funny because
they don't. No, I mean this is some tensor product structure with fixed dimensions, and you know the dimension, say 2 qubits, 1 qubit, 2nd qubit. But for one of the Hamiltonians there is nothing happening on the second qubit, and for the other one there is something happening. You will never be able to see that something happening, but you still know the dimension. Okay. So why are these systems not similar. I mean, why is this possible? It's because they are uncoupled, right? So if we are aiming for the similarity, we need to have the property that our pulses can reach the whole space. If there is some part of the space that we never touched with our shaking, then there's no chance that we can ever learn something about it. Okay, so and you can derive the following theorem here, which is that if your pulses reach everything, then equivalence and similarity are equivalent to each other. It sounds terrible, but one implies the other. So what I mean with the pulses reach the whole space is this well-known thing from control theory here that the Lie algebra generated by the system Hamiltonian and by the pulses, so the smallest vector space that contains these matrices and that is closed under the Hagen commutator is maximal. So if this is the case, then the two are equivalent. And this property here is something that you can test in your system, right? So it's not efficient to test it. It's not possible in practice, but in theory, you can look at the input-output behavior of your system, and you can try to find a quantum mechanical realization. And if you find a minimal realization that is equivalent to if you find you can't get smaller than this, and it has the same sort of complexity, in other words, it can encrypt quantum computation, that's the way I think about it, then you know that this property is fulfilled. So I have to be careful here, but you could claim that this is also a property which is likely to hold. And this goes back to some work by Seth Lloyd, who showed that if you take a random Hamiltonian and a second random Hamiltonian, then with probability 1, the two of them will generate everything. Now, of course, we have to be careful here because the Hamiltonians that we find in nature are not really random with respect to some, say, Haar measure or so, but they have specific properties. But okay, so I won't go into more detail of that, but I would like to argue that in many cases you will have this property that you can do, you can touch everything.
Do you have a notion of, for you, little d is arbitrary, right?
It's arbitrary but known.
Yeah, but I mean, you could be talking about thermodynamically large systems, or you could be talking about small subsystems. I mean, it could be anything, right?
Yeah. I'm not talking about efficiency or anything like that, or the computational complexity of even doing this.
No, the random argument depends for efficiency mean, and D matters quite a bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
So once we accept this, we now have a simple mathematical characterization of systems which are indistinguishable. So under the premise of reachability, the system is identifiable up to similarity. So let's see what that means. Okay. So assume some component X of your system is known. So in the previous part, I said that everything is inside the box. We don't even know what Hamiltonian we switch on and off, we don't even know what we measure. But now that's not very realistic. Let's assume that we know something about the system. Let's assume we know that we can measure Pauli Z or something like that. Okay. So in that case, so we know something. In that case, obviously whatever we estimate, so let's call the estimated system X hat, must be equal to the real thing for this specific operator, because we know it. So this means, by similarity, that the unitary transformation that could still be there, and the unitary transformation could mean that we haven't really estimated the system, but we've only estimated up rotation, must leave this specific known element invariant. In other words, the unitary must commute with the element that we know. Okay. So each known element about your system constrains the possible systems that behave in the same way. And then the interesting thing, or the thing that I find interesting at least, is that if you have two things that you know, then by Jacobi identity, of course the unitary has also to commute with a commutator of these two things that you know. And it's also linear. So this means that the Lie algebra that is generated by the things you know has to commute with the similarity transformation. Okay, so this means that, okay, so this is the formal way of writing this. It means that if there's nothing that commutes with what you know, then the system is fully identical and identifiable up to a unique point. So this, what I mean here is that you take the Lie algebra of what you know, and you take the commutant of that, so the elements that commute with that, and if that is proportional to the identity, then your system is uniquely identifiable.
You mentioned the issue of systematic errors.
Yes.
So is this known perfectly or known with some degree of certainty?
Okay, so I know there are obviously many different things that people mean when they say systematic errors. Mm-hmm. And for example, I'm not worried about statistics here. So what I would call a systematic error is the existence of such a unitary. So if there is a unitary that rotates everything, you will never be able to see it. So you make a systematic mistake about your measurement, about your system, about the state, and in such a way that you'll never be able to see it. So if this criterion here is fulfilled, then you don't have such systematic errors in my language. I don't know if this is a sound.
Well, I guess I would say, so you may use the example, I measure sigma z. Let's say I measure slightly rotated sigma z.
Yeah. Then you would, if this is true, you would never notice that. Sorry. Yeah, so?
Could we ask about the notation? W here, is that a unitary element of the diagram?
W is a unitary.
But is that that's not the W you were talking about,
that's
normally
the W. It is the W, I was
saying. Oh, it is the W.
Yeah. It is the, what I'm saying is the unitary has to commute with everything you know. Because what you estimate and what you know must be the same. I mean, what is in your system and what you estimate must be the same, if you know it. And so the unitary must leave that element invariant. So it must commute with it.
Could you specify what you mean by known things? It's a class of operators.
What I mean with knowing things?
Known things, yes.
Yeah, I mean if.
I understood know.
If you have an experiment and you say, I know the initial state is the one where all spins point down, then this operator, the density matrix corresponding to it, would be one of the known things. Or if you say, I know that my measurement is perfectly sigma z, and I think maybe that comes back to your question, Ivan, because I don't know how to characterize if you say, I know it's sigma z plus minus something.
Yeah, that's really my question.
Yeah.
Right.
And this is much more important, of course.
Sure.
Okay, so maybe the takeaway message of this talk is that I like this object here, this Lie algebra of the known things, because I find it quite funny to build a Lie algebra not just out of Hamiltonian, but out of measurements, Hamiltonians, and states. So you kind of have all of them, and you take their commutators, and you build up this Lie algebra. And this is something I hadn't done before, and I found it somehow amusing to do it. So, of course, you can use the same generality argument, just a second, to claim that in general, knowing two things about your experiment suffices to identify everything. So this is one of the things that comes out of set logic results. Sorry, you had another question.
You might know this already, but Stefan, that's the same condition that you have for a open system map to be ergodic. So if you have a Hamiltonian and a bunch of limb-led jets, this is exactly the condition you would check. So there's some notion of ergodicity of your system. That it's exploring all of state space.
Right. Okay. I you mean the same as being having the cross operators and the commutant of the cross operators being
the Lindblad operator. So in the generator, if you have a master equation, you have to.
Right.
You asked a question about the spirit of, but I think you mentioned that you wanted to think about these others as representing systematic errors. But if I understand the setup that you have, kind of the idea is you have some black box in the lab and you put in signals and you get out signals.
Yeah.
So, like the real thing is really the transfer function, so to speak, or the general behavior. Right. So what is your system? Your system is some operator on that takes input signals down to signals. I mean, that's the only observable thing, so it's only sort of real thing. And so if we now say that, all right, I want to make some state-space realization of this behavior, then that's where you actually then have to fix what all these operators are. And in particular, that's the step at which you might fix the W's. But, I mean, given that the only kind of real thing is the, right, is the map, or the signals, not the signals, W would seem to me to be an arbitrary thing. It's basically a choice of coordinate system.
Okay, that's a good point, and I think I can address it on the next slide. Another thing is that, so you might not take this argument that knowing two things about your experiments is enough, because that's a kind of probabilistic argument. But if you were to control and measure 2n Paulis on your system, and if your system is coupled, if there is no part that is completely uncoupled to the rest, then I can guarantee to you that the system is identifiable. So in terms of comparing that to process tomography, it's actually an exponential advantage, because you don't need to measure products of Pauli operators, but just individual Pauli operators. So coming back to your question, let me just take one example, and I think we'll see more clearly what this W does. So let's take some Hamiltonian. This is a Heisenberg Hamiltonian here, so some one-dimensional system. Where they're coupled with a Heisenberg interaction doesn't really matter now, but just as an example. And let's say we control here sigma x and sigma y on the first side, and we measure sigma x on the first side. So everything we do is on the first side. And let's say we know that we do that. So we know that the control Hamiltonian is exactly x1, so the estimated system and the real system coincide. Okay, so then actually it turns out that I can prove for you for this specific system that it is controllable. So the Lie algebra generated by these guys is maximal. So in some sense we have a quantum computer in some sense. But of course the Lie algebra of the things we know, right, which is just this, is quite small. It's just SU2 on the first side. So the set of unitaries that leave this guy invariant are just the ones which do nothing here and something on the rest. So it's a large class that has many unknown parameters. So does that mean that as a physicist I should accept every model, you know, up to this unitary transformation as a valid Hamiltonian for my system? And I would say no. You know, even though they have the same input-output behavior, we shouldn't. And the reason is, so however, most of these Hamiltonians, so Heisenberg unitary conjugated with this guy, would be rejected by any experimentalist. And the reason is that they have different symmetries, for example. So we know Heisenberg model conserves excitations, and there are some symmetries in your lab that you know you have. You know that in physics all Hamiltonians are made of two-body interactions. So most of the Hamiltonians that you get by unitary conjugation on Heisenberg will not be able to write them down as sum of two Pauli matrices or something like that. So you can reject them from physical principles. And well, you know, you might know something about Neuse-Neighbor interaction or something like that will also allow you to nail it down further. Okay. So the really interesting and completely open question to me is how to include such an abstract knowledge into what we know about the system. So, you know, I can nail down the Lie algebra by these operators that we know, but I would like to nail it down even further by taking into account these general physical principles in some sense. And at the moment, I'm stuck with knowing how to do that mathematically. For the specific case I showed here, the Heisenberg model, actually you can use specific ways, and then you can find out that this is actually a uniquely identifiable system. So that I won't talk about this in this talk, but if you had something like this, you could uniquely identify it. If you assume that the number of excitations is conserved, and if you assume that it's two-body, and if you assume that the node is one-dimensional. So I hope that answers your question a little bit. Okay, it's time for my conclusion. So in the presence of control, of course, control helps to do system identification. And in general, two known things about your system are already enough to identify everything. So that's much more efficient, well, not efficient, but it needs less operators than process tomography. And what I presented to you with the similarity construction is an easy criterion to check a given experiment, which is protocol independent. So if someone comes along and says, I think I have this Hamiltonian, and these are exactly the measurements that we can take, and these are exactly the control pulses that we can apply, then we can just calculate this Lie algebra and see if something commutes with it. And if there is something that commutes with it, then the Hamiltonian can be more general. And so the experimentalist, in some sense, has to take further assumptions. And these might be physical assumptions, but they have to be made explicit in some sense. Now, as an outlook, what I've presented here is only for closed systems. So it would be very nice to do the same for open systems. And so you can do two things. You could either say, I want to estimate, say, the Hamiltonian in the presence of noise, but I'm interested in the Hamiltonian. Or you could say, I'm interested in the noise as well. So that's the most general question. And it's not at all clear what is going to happen in open systems. So for example, if you're only interested in estimating Hamiltonian, it's easy to make examples where the noise can actually help you to estimate the Hamiltonian. But of course, in general, we expect always that noise is going to make things worse. So it's not going to be a simple and clean answer to this. And as I said on the last slide, I'd be really interested in how to take into account mathematically known symmetries of your system and known physical principles and structures. So thank you for your attention.
Maybe I missed something. Maybe this can be a silly question. Okay. I mean, since you allow arbitrary unitaries, is it wrong to say that you can always rotate to the diagonal basis? Because, you know, in the end, we can always go to the maximum set of commuting things, the maximum tour. So if you start with all the equivalence classes for commuting things and then apply unitaries, is that the way to reach the classes?
Well, I mean, there's no reason why your Hamiltonians can all be simultaneously diagonals. In fact, I'm assuming that they cannot, because they are generating the whole Lie algebra.
But, you know, if you have Lie algebra, if you have SUN, and you apply unitaries, you can always, by unitaries, go to the maximum set of commuting things. This is how you reach this is the theorem, you know.
H0 and HK don't you?
Oh, so that must be the reason. But at least the quarter, it should be, you should be able to take a part of it again.
And maybe we should discuss this on a board, but I mean, I'm kind of assuming that things are maximally uncommuting in some sense because they generate everything.
Yeah. But the Hamiltonian is just a set of all the angular elements, isn't it? I mean, the food system is just expressible in one way or another in terms of the angular elements of the SUN, isn't it?
Yes.
And the unitaries act on the set of all these angular elements. And then we identify some parts belong to this part and this other part. But the whole jump should be able to be written in diagonal form by unitaries.
Let's discuss this on the blackboard.
paper.
So just to get back to that question, you started out asking, when an experimentalist writes a paper and writes down this Hamiltonian, how do you know that that is the Hamiltonian? So, I'd say it kind of at a very fundamental level of how we're talking about these W. I don't think that what we mean when we write it down is that it's somehow objectively true, right? So, this is my model for the way that my system behaves. And the thing that I require of this model is that it should account for the data that I have. And I would also like it to help me kind of understand what's going on or make other predictions about how to control the system, things like that. But it's really just a model, right? And so that gets into these things. I guess one should be careful about the distinction between physical symmetries that you want to kind of require should be true of the models that you write down versus your sort of gauge degrees of freedom in how you write down the model. Right, so getting back to the spin chain thing that you were just saying, if I wanted to, right, as long as I did everything self-consistently, I could use a model in which for this spin, the plus z direction is defined like this, and for the next spin, the plus z direction is defined like that. It would be a silly model to use, but I could use that, right? And so as long as I translated self-consistently between that funny coordinate system and my description of how I'm putting in driving signals and how I'm taking in measurements, that's a perfectly valid model. Right. And it will be related by one of these goofy symmetries.
That's fine. That's fine. But the thing is that if you have the same experiment, but you start doing something else with it, you wouldn't want to write a different Hamiltonian for every single paper that you write, right? Because as you in this case, if you increase the control,
as long as you did everything self-consistently with the similarity transform and everything, you could write them down differently, and none of it would be wrong in a sense, right? In that all of those different models with different internal coordinate systems, they're all descriptions of the same map from input signal to output signal, which is the only thing that you can really hang around on. So it seems to me that particular class of similarity transforms is a modeling degree of freedom rather than a physical thing. Right? And then when you get into some things about, well, now if I fix one thing, I just fix that I'm measuring sigma to z, right, that's in like saying, okay, now I'm going to fix something about my coordinate system, then I'm just going to say that my measurement axis defines the z-axis of the coordinate system. And so in that sense, there's no way that you could have systematic errors, or they wouldn't be identifiable in some sense. So I kind of feel like a lot of this is going to come back to things about covariant measurements, and this is the Dariano and the Fairfellman's people who have written some things about.
I agree that there's a kind of, there is a gauge invariance that is not even worth talking about in some sense, but I think there are clearly some things that are worth talking about, and that is the case when you, in the case of the spin chain, if you increase the control, if you do something else with the experiment, then suddenly some of those models would still be valid and some wouldn't, and we need to be able to talk about that, I think. So I think it's very important to characterize this set. But it does entail some parts which are not physical in some sense, but others are physical.
I think we just have one more question, because Tommaso is.
Of course, your FKs and your shaking reminds me of basis functions in our crab algorithm. So I'm wondering, we were thinking, one could, since shaking in the proper way allows you to reach some goals, which ultimately is I'm trying something and I get some measure. We were thinking, maybe this can give information about the system Hamiltonian spectrum and so on. So I'm wondering, is this a specific case of what you are describing? Is it a specific implementation? Is it something, partially different? So how does it relate?
Yeah, I would say this is the more general case in some sense. It tells you that, this was was also something that I was interested in the beginning, was whether some kind of bootstrapping protocol would help you to learn about the system. So you have a controllable system, but you don't know yet how to control it because your control functions depend on the Hamiltonian. So then you make a good guess for the Hamiltonian, you control it, you measure what you got, and you check whether you got what you thought you should get, and you then update the knowledge of the system or so on. But under the premise of controllability, the systems that are indistinguishable from the real one are exactly those. And there's nothing you can do about it, just even by bootstrapping, you kind of get around it. So in some sense, it was a little bit disappointing because I would have liked a protocol that kind of converges towards the truth.
Okay, you see, such a protocol does not exist.
At least not in this framework, no.
Okay. because we thought it could, so maybe we, I mean, beyond this discussion, we can
have a conversation. Right. So I think the talk is stimulating a lot of good discussion, but I think we're trying to keep a little time, so thank you again.